what we like to do here of relationship advice for the automotive world. It's a very popular segment. And
my wife thinks I'm an expert on relationships. So this is perfect.
Wait, really?
It's an okay time to tell Brian that this is actually an intervention that she asked for.
just hang on a second. We have somebody else joining in the lobby.
We have Brian's mother and father and his wife. Oh.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of The Wheelhouse. Not just any episode. This is the 20th episode. That's right. 19 episodes after the first time somebody said, what the heck is that? We're still here with even better and more engaging content and a whole new panel of super interesting, I promise you, people that you're going to want to hear from. So let me first introduce who we've got, because our producers, Jordan Cox and Nathan Southwick, thanks to both of you guys, really pulled out a fantastic panel for us today. So Savannah Sims, Director of Business Development at the Sims Auto Group. I realize also a comment I made pre-show. Just want to apologize for that. Jonathan Dawson, coach and trainer at Salcology. Brian Kramer, VP at Cars Commerce and the GM of AccuTrade. Michael Wood, who's the GM of Checkered Flag Auto Group. So we've got GM, GM, President, BDC, Director, and a whole new show of The Wheelhouse for you guys today. I want to quick remind everybody that we do have our very own disclaimer here on The Wheelhouse. It's not very official, but they told us we should at least be saying something like, the views and opinions expressed here by the speakers are the speakers their own and do not represent their affiliates, the companies that employ them, or affiliates of that company. Now that we've got that out of the way, we usually like to go around the horn and do a 30-second update on things. What are you seeing in your corner of the automotive world, month to date, year to date, depending on how often you're here, Michael? So, we'll go ahead and start with you since you know how it goes. 30 seconds on the clock for you. Go.
Things are looking pretty good this year so far. We're up in volume on the variable side at both JLR and VW, and our net to grosses are looking really healthy on the fixed operations side, despite the fact that we're down a few technicians at both stores. We're getting a little bit more hours per hour on every single repair order. So we're just getting a little bit better with what we have. So I'm really happy with the business so far in the first quarter, through the first quarter of 2024.
Yeah, rough life in the world of JLR, I understand. Okay.
It's tough.
Yeah, word is you guys aren't having gold plated in the employee break room anymore. It's Ms. Savannah Sims, Director of Business Development, the Sims Auto Group, 30 seconds on the clock for you.
All right, we have about 10 seconds for every week we've been in business. So we're 3 weeks into our first store and things are going well so far. I think the most surprising thing has just been lease percentages. We know they're down across the board, but as low as we have been in ever. So I think that's pretty much the biggest takeaway from variable side. Fixed, things are going very well. Fleet business is strong and just got a lot of work ahead of us.
What brands do you have?
Right now we have Ford and Lincoln. We have three more closing in April.
Oh, okay. All right. Keep us updated. Mr. Jonathan Dawson, who gets to travel and experience dealers all across the country, and many of them come to you also. 30 seconds on the clock for you.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I would say that it's not to surprise most people watching this that turnover has gone up and a need to, quote, return to the basics has become ever present in most dealerships' conversations. So dealers are wanting their sales team to get back to the 101s, the blocking and tackling, as they say, of taking care of the customer, tracking your numbers, asking for the sale, building rapport. So a lot of my dealers are coming to me and saying, John, help my people just return back to basic selling.
People can call you John. I didn't know that. You told me I had to call you Mr. Dawson.
It's actually Mr. The Jonathan Dawson, the Magnificent. It's the correct order.
Okay.
Esquire.
Yeah. Yeah, I enjoy how many times are the in the car business we want to get back to basics or return to normal.
Right.
Gosh, if it ain't for a lack of trying. Okay, 30 seconds on the clock, Mr. Brian Kramer.
Well, keeping along with that thing, I think that a lot of dealers are either finding out that they haven't been blocking and tackling, you know, is another buzzword, or that they need to get back to blocking and tackling. And here's what I mean by that. As I go into dealerships, I think it's really one of two different camps. And sometimes it's the same franchise. Sometimes it's the same location, could be right across the street. But as I'm talking to dealers, one dealer will say that times are tough. Another dealer will say it's not. It ultimately comes down to lead handling, how they're communicating, answering the client's questions, and not taking things for granted that we took for granted during COVID.
yeah, we are good at taking things for granted. I will say, to the point about like lease payments, because I'm, you know, beginning of the month going through all the different OEMs trying to figure out what our, you know, what our program is going to be and what we should advertise. And I wish they could get all on the same page for what they want their leasing programs. Like, how we can we get back to leasing, or is that not something we want to do? Can we just be honest about it? Because a lot of these OEMs are advertising lease programs. I mean, you understand that domestic OEMs, not all, but domestic OEMs advertising upwards of $10,000 down on a lease, right? $5,000 cap cost reduction plus tax, title, and license. $10,000 down on leases. Can we just say, no, this is just something we don't want to do?
Or like $7,500 of it's coming from EV credits, it's really not $10,000.
But I'm saying, even if it's not EV or net of EV, like it is. So, all right, let's get to some headlines here. We know that America needs more trade skilled workers. We talk about it at a lot of pretty much every conference that I've been to. We talk about how we need to recruit technicians for the next generation. And it looks like Gen Z seems to be answering the call for this. And starting in COVID, where we saw a huge uptick in vocational studies, especially enrollments in construction related fields, is auto going to be on their list? And is this seems to be happening independent of what we've been trying to do in the car business and our automotive industry. What can we do to take advantage of this?
I think this is an interesting topic. I have a nephew who's Gen Z, and when he graduated from high school, he didn't want to go to college. He wanted to get into the trades, and specifically, he wanted to be a carpenter. And, you know, I wanted to influence him, obviously. I was like, hey, why don't you come check out being an apprentice technician with me? I'll buy your tools. I'll take care of any kind of fiscal responsibility. I just want you to be able to learn the trade. And even with that kind of barrier removed from him, he didn't have that desire to want to get into the trade. Now, obviously, this is just a one-off. It's my one nephew, not indicative of the entire Gen Z population. But it was just interesting, the negative connotation that it still remains with becoming an automotive technician. And despite the fact that the five of us all know that technicians can make a great living today, and it's only going to get better. I just thought that was kind of interesting.
I think it's interesting that you offered to buy somebody tools. I haven't even gotten a hat from you for all the cars I've sold. But
I got a good bottle of wine for you in next month at some little conference.
Thank you. But don't technicians, I mean, most of our technicians make six figures, right? Where's our disconnect between where we're at in automotive and what the rest of skilled labor is seeing? Where's our gap, and how do we stop
it? It's in marketing. We don't market it.
Yeah,
we don't. We talk about how much salespeople can make and sell the vision, the story. We don't do that same thing for technicians.
Yeah, there's bad messaging in general. We don't get out into the market and tell people our story. We don't feature and highlight the success stories within our own organization. We don't profile them on our website. You know, we don't make it we just don't act like it's important. And so it's surprising, maybe, if you look at it.
We're afraid they're going to get recruited. That's why we don't put them up on the website.
I'd be curious if they're going over to more high tech as well, and they're going directly to, you know, Tesla or Rivian. Are they viewing that as a more promising career because of the benefits that go along with that, instead of going directly to a local dealership?
Yeah, if I knew how to work the sound pad that Nathan made me buy, I would give that like 15 ding, ding, dings right there. But I don't. So, yeah, because
Savannah's also right about software engineers. We lose them on our side to Tesla because it's a halo brand.
And because remember when I said, look how Tesla advertises for talent? Look how they recruit. Yep. Look at all the things that they give you. Look at all the insurances they pay for. Look at the clear demonstrated growth path they do.
Try being like a Volvo and McLaren dealership in Palo Alto, a block from all the R&D offices. Of course they're going to go work there. They can get their dry cleaning, you know, all of these things that you don't get in a traditional dealership. But then they come people and they love them.
Yeah. And the question might actually be is, do they not want to become technicians, or do they not want to become involved with the dealer model? Because of everything they've heard, whether it be right or wrong, you know, with the vast majority of dealers not being in the good camp and then the good ones being in the small camp, do they not want to work the 70 hours that they hear technicians have to work, or get treated the way that they hear technicians have to get treated, when they can go work for Bob's Heating and Cooling and work Monday through Friday, weekends off, and all that kind of stuff? Like, is some of this our own doing, or maybe our predecessors' own doing?
Yeah, if we just went around and pulled our friends and said, like, what's the craziest package, total rewards package you've ever put together for like an incredibly qualified technician? I mean, I think we could hear some pretty, I mean, I know what I've done. I mean, it has commas in it, like multiples, right? Yep. And so I don't really want us to be losing these people to other, you know, and Tesla and Rivian aren't technologically more advanced than the cars that we represent and the brands that we represent in the car itself, not in the company, but in the car itself. All right. Yep. Moving on. A topic that we've discussed before, because we need talent in the car business. We don't have talent in the car business. So I came across an interesting article, and I want you guys to appreciate just how far the wheelhouse goes to research material for these shows. It granted used to just be fortune cookies, but we've moved way far past that. I read the Georgia Law Review, the actual publication that they put online. Anyway, an article in which they give guidance to businesses and their clients in Georgia. And to paraphrase, but you can look it up, they're saying, yeah, there's so much use in Georgia that people think it's legal. It's not. So you have to remind people it's actually not. Like, that's in the official guidance. Remind people, just because people do it everywhere, it's not legal. And two, that in positions where they're not safety related positions, that you may want to look at what your guidelines are for testing and for hiring people. The Law Review said that. The people that review the law, I don't know exactly what that means, but that's what they do. And they said, you might want to reconsider that. Are we still losing good people because of old held beliefs?
Yes. We went through this in a public retailer that I worked at, and they determined, because they're in most of the states, they determined that it wasn't worth, there's enough battles you're going to fight. That's not the, the war you want to lose or the hill you want to die on. So they opted to not do that. And specifically, as they were saying, when you're talking about in fixed operations, and it doesn't mean that they're, if somebody's impaired on the job in a safety situation, but what people do at home, in my opinion, that's their business and it's 2024. And we need to start focusing on the things that matter. It'll show up in the results. It'll show up in, if they're doing that stuff at work, they're not going to be as productive. And it'll all shake out. If they wreck a car while they're there, then obviously they got to get tested. But that's my take on it.
But even that, you have to challenge the question of why are you testing them? The test isn't going to tell you that they're impaired at the time. The test is going to tell you that they had marijuana in their system. And so it's like, until we can get some real science behind this, we need to make sure that we're not, killing people out of our industry that are good employees because they like to go home and, toke a joint after work instead of drinking a fifth of whiskey. I mean, what do you, I have a real problem with this one just simply because it just doesn't make sense. It fails the say it out loud test. And it's all predicated, in my opinion, and Daniel will probably correct me if I'm wrong on this one, but it's about the federal laws. I mean, we need to get the federal government on board to get rid of the whole aspect when it comes to workman's comp and all that. And then a lot of these conversations go away because the insurability aspect is different for the dealers. But it's dumb.
Well, yeah. My philosophy is similar to my philosophy of customer generation, which is your best customer should be your lead generators for your best next customer. We should have a business that's based on referrals. And in the same way, when it comes to recruiting and hiring, your best employee should be your referral generators for your next employee. And so as long as high quality people are attracting and recruiting high quality people for you, you should be fine. It's when you don't have processes that you end up having to deal with the consequences.
Yeah, what a great recruiting tagline that would be. We want talented people that work hard and we don't care if you smoke weed. I mean, you'd have to polish it up a little.
Probably not putting that on a billboard.
You just throw it into AI engine and have it spit back out something that's a little bit more politically correct.
30K is a big topic that we hear about for cars. It's got new cars got to be under 30 grand to sell it. EVs got to be under 30 grand to sell it. ICE vehicles got to be under 30 grand to sell it. Is 30 grand just the mark? Is that just the number? Does it matter if it's ICE or EV? Is 30 grand just easier to swallow? And at that point, does the discussion of EV and adoption and charging networks, does it all fade away? What is 30 grand? And tell me what this means for EV and ICE.
I think what it just means is that the customers are looking for affordability. I think that's just the number one word for 2024 is, can we afford this vehicle? How does it compare to the last transaction that I did? And how does it compare to the more expensive vehicles? But they just happen to correlate to the 30K price vehicles. And I think to your point, whether it's EV or not, I don't think it really matters. If I've got a under 30, under 25K car, it's just not going to sit as long as the $45,000 to $55,000 cars will, period.
When the interest rates drop, I think we'll obviously see the 30K go up quite a bit. But the other thing is the cost of ownership. And if that's what matters to a customer, also what credits are they getting on that? But I think ICE or EV, just keeping the affordability, payments, and the interest rate are all going to play a big part.
It's almost like 30K ICE, 25K EV, because once you get to that 25 EV, then you can start getting the EV tax credit, you know, as long as you meet all the stipulations, et cetera. It's like a little delineation from the 30K.
So then does it matter? I mean, does anyone, so it doesn't matter.
Yes, it does matter. If you take a look at the algorithms of what the public retailers are doing, the Carvanas, CarMaxes of the world, there's a distinct shift, and you'll see the franchise dealers at the auction put their hands down. And you'll see all the proxies from all these other public retailers, not just CarMax and Carvana, but the new car franchisees that are buying those cars. And they're all in their shareholder report talking about what percentage of their mix is it within that price band. So like Carvana, for instance, on 30,000 cars, they attribute the fact that they maintain 55% of their inventory in less than the $25,000 price band as to why they only have on 30,000 cars, 6% of their cars aging. Because to Michael's point, that's when all the cars turn. But there is a heavy emphasis on that. And we see it as we're adjusting our AccuTrade values to keep up in that price band, because there's a distinct uptick on what, you know, so we do it now. We do it for a lot of big public retailers that are our clients. And they say, look, if it's a 25 grand or less, we want to put at least $1,000 more, or in some cases, you know, 6 to 10% more in that vehicle, you know, based on their customized pricing for that reason.
But Brian, isn't the question, at least the way I understood it, was does it matter if it's an EV or a nice car at that price point? Does that matter? Or is it really just affordability, which is the price point relative to interest rates and term?
I think it just comes down to interest rates and term, but I think some dealers do a better job of it than others. I've seen dealers that have a 18 Camry with 50,000 miles on it. Customer comes in on it. Hey, you know, if we can't get there on the payment, by the way, I've got, so they do sets and subsets. And then right next to it is four or five Teslas that they bought at the auction that they're switching to people on because they can achieve that payment on a little newer EV. And it, ultimately, it is payment to answer your question. But I think that the strategy and how dealers go about it is the key to execution.
I think the only thing I would change in my answer, I guess, now that I think about it a little bit, is the dealership's attitude towards new EVs. And so if a dealership has a great attitude towards selling new EVs, then I don't think it's going to matter whether it's EV or ICE under 30K, because that staff is going to have an environment where they welcome the EV conversation. They're able to help the customer and transition them from ICE to EV. But in those dealerships that are consistently battling against the idea of EV, then I think it will matter for them under 30K as to whether
it, you it just know, seems like it's two hot button conversations. And I just wish we'd make up our minds, because it's like we got a hot button conversation about under 30 grand. We got a hot button conversation about ICE or EV. Right. And it's like, now the two of them collide. This is the intersection of the two of them colliding. And then all of a sudden, then we kind of mumbled. Now we've got, I'm not sure which one then is the one I'm going to press on.
Here's the reason why, Daniel, because a lot of people will say, no, my market doesn't want to sell
the algorithm. Movies.
And each market is different. And I'm sure there's an algorithm somewhere, somehow.
If there is, you'll find it.
I don't have one on this one, but all I can tell you is the same dealers that 6 months ago told me that EVs don't sell in their market are now saying that EVs priced less than 25 grand do sell in their market because of payments. And not because they were trying to, because they took one in on trade and all of a sudden they kept on selling. So now their stocking report says to keep them. And it wasn't by most of the time it wasn't by strategy, it was by accident that they came to that conclusion.
I mean, it just used to be like, look, you were with Mercedes for a while. I just feel like it's like we used to say, like, any Mercedes you can lease for $599, people will lease it. Now it's like,
did he freeze up?
Did I freeze up? No, not yet.
Hertz and everybody offloading all this like pre-owned EV. Yeah. I think that's going to play a big toll in those numbers we're going to see over the next few months.
Yeah, because Hertz dumped like, you know, however many thousands and thousands of these cars, and they're all available now for 20 grand. So you're going to see a blip or a blop because of that. But it mostly has to do, again, it's affordability at that point. People are buying the payment. They're not buying the car.
That's a blop. That's a full-on blopper right there. Let me ask you guys, because I consider this panel to have a lot of expertise in this. Tell me how you characterize – this isn't the next topic. Sorry, I should have said that. How do you characterize a winning culture, something that is sustainable, that's going to win today, but it's also set up to win tomorrow? What characteristics does that culture have, or how do you characterize it? And Jonathan, I'd love to put you on the spot first.
Yeah, I appreciate it. So I'm honored to be able to say I work with a lot of very high volume, high producing, top ranked stores in their market nationally. So I can say that with some degree of certainty, it comes down to the spirit of the leadership team and whether or not they create an atmosphere that encourages training, encourages development, that encourages individual empowerment. These are the things that help a dealership thrive culturally is having leaders who aren't intimidated by successful people. A lot of stores have a manager who won't let anybody get better because they're afraid of losing their job. And so if you have a solid leadership team that believes in developing people and wants to grow them and strengthen their skill sets, that's a cultural phenomenon that will help you win.
I love it.
What he said.
Great. Great. How do we use that fourth square for you, Michael?
All right. For me personally, too, I think it has a lot to do with like the words that you hear around the dealership. Do you hear a lot of I and me, or do you hear a lot of we and our? And for me, that's a big mind shift change, because then it's no longer that's my customer that I'm taking care of. That's our customer that we are taking care of. And that's going to bring an experience that's going to create the revenue and the profitability that I want in my stores. And more importantly, it's going to create a culture that's demonstrably different than what's out there in the marketplace, so that I can continue to attract the top talent and then bring them in and continue it to, his point, invest in them. We promote from within. We don't go out and hire managers from the outside. And so I think once you get them in here and you have that right culture, they're going to stay. And that turnover point that you were making earlier, it just kind of starts to go away. We still have it, but it's not as bad as the industry averages. But I think it's the I and the me versus the we and the our really help out.
It's interesting. Recently, we just spent 2 days in a room with 30 leaders across the stores we've either already acquired or we're acquiring. We have a blank sheet of paper. What is this group going to be? What do you see for the future? And hearing what they thought, because I can give you my answer, but hearing what they thought was important in the way that we set up a brand new audit group. It was innovation, collaboration, and transparency. And the word family was brought up so much, and so was the word community. And I feel like a family and a community that are both very high functioning, they allow sharing ideas. They actually value shared ideas. And if someone comes forward with a question, rather than saying, don't worry about it, they're going to educate you on it and bring you into that and make them a part of the decision-making process. And from doing that from day one, it was interesting to see all the different stores come together. And by the end, you had no idea whose idea was whose. They were completely in line and the buy-in was there.
That's awesome. That's a fantastic. I mean, are you going to do it again, though, in 90 days to see how you're tracking?
It's been an interesting taking all the pages of ideas. And now we're doing small group calls to get there. But yes, there will be regular check-in.
And is family something that you want included in the description for your group?
It is not, actually. It's something that we've talked about, even auto group, what's important. And there's a quote out there from another article recently, but it was family is not blood. Family for us, succession isn't our family, it's your family. And that buy-in for the general managers and being partners and opportunities beyond just a general manager is something we need to really consider moving forward as well.
And Savannah, if I could add just a piece of wisdom from helping stores establish core values and mission statements for years now. One thing to do is you take these ominous words, right? Transparency or innovation. These are really great idea, buzzword type things to put on a poster. But really what you want to do is ask them, practically living that out, what is demonstrable about that word? What would that look like if we were to recognize it, if we were to identify it, if we could ever, call somebody and say, hey, I noticed you lived out this core value. What would that statement end with? Like, what did you say? What would be the way to describe it? I think if you can get them to go from a concept to a practical application of how to live out that core value and get them to articulate that openly in multiple different variations, that's when you'll have a solidified idea of what that looks like.
That's spot on. Applying it even to mobile service or a concierge program, applying those to each of those is where we started getting, further down in the process. So I love that. Thank you.
Yeah. Famous thing that were taught to us by, I think most people in the military will remember it, that family, like blood only determines relation. Family is determined by loyalty. And I think loyalty is something that dealerships should go for, both from the people that work for the dealership, as well as clients that come to give their money to that dealership. I think loyalty is something to aspire to.
I completely agree with you, Daniel. And in the winning dealerships I go into, if I see somebody is backing up the person next to them when they're not sitting there, or they're getting, like Jonathan said earlier, consistent answers and clarity, and they're not saying, well, what I think should happen versus, what they say when somebody else is sitting next to them, when there's no daylight between coworkers and they actually trust that person, or they say, I'm not comfortable signing up with your product without getting the rest of my team on board. I think those are the signs of a winning culture through loyalty and trust. Like they really do trust the people they work with.
It was a heated debate, Danny. I think you might have been there for it when Patrick Abad and I were debating at a conference. Do you remember? And it was about whether or not you want loyal team members. And his argument was effectively that he didn't, that he argued against it. Now, Patrick, for those that don't know, is the number one volume dealership in the state of Georgia, and their store's only been open for 5 years. And he surpassed every other dealership in the state in 5 years. And his philosophy, which was interesting, and it's really an interesting way to look at it. He said, I really don't want loyal people. What I want is I want people that could be loyal, but not actually loyal in this way. He said, I want to always earn their loyalty. If they're loyal to me, I'll take them for granted. And his fear was, if I believe my people are loyal to me, I'll stop pursuing them and create an environment where they'll want to be loyal to me. And so I thought that was just an interesting way of describing his way of looking at loyalty. It's like, I don't want them to actually be loyal. I want to always be afraid I can lose them so that I never do. And I thought that was really interesting.
Okay. Well, St. Patrick, as he's known, is better than all of us here. And you're right. And I do love what, I mean, it's just like, I aspire to get to his level where I could be able to say something like that. Yeah. Because that's an amazing thought process to have. I'll also just bring up, just as a counterpoint, Patrick doesn't care that your car sells data to third parties, and just know that your car is selling your data now to your insurance company. So, you know, and he said that on this podcast too. So I just have to point that out, because as much as I love him, you know, there's that. Segueing into changes, what changes are you guys seeing in the workforce, in your workforce, in other workforces that you know about, and in recruiting? What changes do you guys see coming to your organizations this year? Anybody looking at different scheduling types, remote work, hybrid work? Anybody, is that making its way into being more prevalent in our workforce? Or have you seen it working better somewhere else? Tell me.
I'm talking to multiple dealerships that are pursuing 4-day work weeks. I know Walzer just kicked that off. Peter Bowler at Toyota has been doing it for a few years. Jermaine Toyota is in the process of mapping all of that out, you know, at a large volume store. So I think, and I don't know that everybody wants to do it. You know, I don't know if people want to work 10 hours straight. But I think that giving people the option to be able to do that, to be able to take long weekends and have more flexibility, obviously goes back to the Gen Z conversation from earlier.
Hey, Kramer, when you said 10 hours, are you talking about the part-time schedule of only 10 hours a day?
I don't know anyone that can get away with just 10 hours.
Part-time. So I have stores that have been on modified schedules for a long time, especially at earned privileges of schedule release. So, for example, I work with in the Pinnacle Society. We work with, you know, so many high achieving, top producing salespeople. Many of them just have the internal leverage to set their own schedule. But we have salespeople who sell 30 cars a month, working 3 days a week. A gentleman who sold 64 cars last month only worked 19 days the whole month. That store only has a 4-day scheduled work week. They have 4 salespeople and sold 143 cars with 4 people. So it is not about more in the sense of time. It's about efficiency and effectiveness while they're at the store. And if we can help our people build systems around their processes so they can be successful consistently, the reality is you don't need to be there 50 and 60 hours a week like the old kind of school thinking was. You can be there 4 days a week and sell 40 cars a month. And I've got plenty of people who blueprinted that out and prove it every single month. So I encourage dealerships to consider truly developing a work-life balance for their employees where they can enjoy that. But in order to do that, you have to build a quality book of business that will create for you that quality of life that you want. And we don't, unfortunately, when it comes to like comp plans and the ways that we set up our stores' incentivization structures, we don't teach salespeople how to build a quality book of business. And because we don't teach them, incentivize them to do that, and we only measure the quantified metrics, not the qualified metrics, we have salespeople that, you know, have to be there bell to bell oftentimes. And that's, and of course, leads to the turnover.
In the state of California, they also make it quite difficult to lean into some of these more creative solutions. We just were at the dealer day for CNCDA, and we were talking about that. You know, I want to make it so that you can be at your daughter's volleyball game or coach your son's baseball team. And so I'm okay with, you know, alternative schedules within my own store for that reason. And typically, like you both said, those top performers are the ones with those more flexible schedules. But the state in California is at least making it extremely difficult.
Yeah, this is one of the number one things I want to look for this year. I was talking to Erica a week ago from the Walzer Group about it and just asking her, I was like, hey, can you and I have a one-on-one conversation? Because I work my schedule and I want my staff to work their schedule. But unfortunately, if you look at certain positions within the dealership, whether it's the service consultant position or the salesperson position, they typically seem to be the ones that when I'm approving time cards every 2 weeks are logging 100 to 120 hours in that pay period or more. And it's just maddening because, you know, when I signed up to work for Checkered Flag, I didn't sign a contract that says that Checkered Flag now owns me and I'm going to give them 100% of my time whenever they see fit. I signed a contract that said for 40 hours a week, you're going to give me X dollars based on what I can produce. And to Mr. Dawson's point, if I'm more efficient in the time that I'm here, doesn't mean that I'm lazy, doesn't mean that I'm, you know, not good according to what the standards have been in the past, because I've heard that before. Oh, Mike just works his schedule. Well, point out the flaw. Point out to what I'm doing wrong or point out to where you're beating me and I'm happy to put in more time. But just because one works the schedule and you don't doesn't make them wrong. And I just feel to Savannah's point, like I want my staff going to their soccer games. I want them coaching their little league teams so that I can sponsor the team. So that I've got the Checkered Flag logo out on all their uniforms and I've got a really, really happy bought in employee. That's the difference.
I know we were talking about Gen Z earlier as well, but you look at the tech companies and how flexible their schedules are and work from home and unlimited PTO. We all know unlimited PTO means we're not going to take it, but it's something that we do need to consider is the work-life balance and the wellness programs. And you go work for an OEM and they'll pay for all your family planning and IVF and all of that. But I mean, they're at a single point dealership. We're not seeing that. So those benefits along with the schedule are things we're going to need to think about with the next generation. And, you know, to your point as well, the teaching them how to build the book of business and how hard it's going to be, because that demographic likely only knows COVID where we're taking orders. They don't understand the harvesting the business, nurturing that, the box of index cards with all the notes of the family members now that are in DriveCentric or whatever your CRM is, but the hard work.
I would also add non-monetary motivations and incentivizations are really important too. When you're building out your strategy, you have to look at it and say, okay, not everybody wants to simply see an extra, you know, couple bucks in their checking account. Some of them want to see something more purposeful to what they do. So can you find out within your organization how you can support local causes, charities, organizations, and create an outlet for people to feel like what they're doing has a greater purpose beyond the actual paycheck? Also looking at unique ways to structure bonuses and other perks. You know, a lot of times what it'll be like just some sort of cash incentive. The classic, you know, cliche is, you know, $500 spiff. But the reality is, again, to the average person, if you just give them a $500 spiff, that money doesn't get to go to whatever they want. I mean, if I'm married and have three kids and give me a $500 spiff, it goes to toilet paper and toothpaste. It doesn't go towards me buying a new TV. So instead, what I've taught stores to do is to do cash equivalency spiffs, where they can earn an amount of money valued at X that they can then assign that money to go towards something. So if I'm a newlywed and I've got two small kids, you know, and I want to take my wife on a weekend trip and I have $500 that I just won, my wife's not going to let me spend that on us. She's going to say, no, it goes to the kids. But if I, instead of winning $500 in a spiff, if I win a certificate to the W Hotel and a Ruth Chris, and if I win a night out, I can go home to my bride and say, look what I won for us. Now let's get a sitter so we can go enjoy ourselves. It's thinking more creatively about how do we incentivize, how do we motivate beyond just throwing money at people.
Oh, you just weren't supposed to say anything when you won a spiff. But anyway.
The closet money.
Well, it's like at our VW store, you know, I have it set for them. It's every given month. If you sell 16 cars, you have the choice of an additional $500 or you have a free day off. And I don't pay the $500 out. They take the day off. Mm-hmm.
I would add to that then, just if you're going to do that kind of thing, like I said, consider putting other things on the menu other than just time.
No, it's a great idea for sure.
For example, a salesperson may want to see themselves marketed better. So instead of just giving them $500 that goes to toilet paper and toothpaste, put in a marketing allowance that you can then help them redirect that marketing into whether it be tchotchke things they can give to their customers or some Facebook advertising, but show them how to grow their business with what they incentivize through their success instead of it, like I said, just going on the bills.
Basically put your 3 sets of toilet paper and then have the equivalent of that for $500.
Yeah, exactly. And have your team come up with that. Ask each person, hey, if there was a prize, what would be the prize? Let's say there was a $500 level, a $750 level, a $1,000 level. What would you want to spend that money on if you won it? Get them to tell you. and then monetize the cash equivalency of time and say, okay, if you don't win, if you win the $1,000 prize, you can do that, or it's this much time. I'm just saying, start getting very creative and trying to align the behaviors that you want, the outcomes that you want, with incentives and motivators that they want, and you'll see the change. That's how you can get salespeople to 20 cars or 30 cars a month and beyond.
Okay, so segueing right into a lightning round of what we like to do here of relationship advice for the automotive world. It's a very popular segment. And
my wife thinks I'm an expert on relationships. So this is perfect.
Wait, really?
This is okay time to tell Brian that this is actually an intervention that she asked for.
just hang on a second. We have somebody else joining in the lobby.
We have Brian's mother and father and his wife.
Oh. Signs that a dealership just isn't that into you.
Savannah? How about on the About Us page? There's no photo of you. There's no staff page. There's no photo. There's no bio. They took down your photo and put a silhouette up instead.
Maybe they just didn't want you to get recruited, though.
And then they don't have confidence in their own leadership to be able to share and recruit more business for you, right?
Okay. All right. What other signs at your dealership, if you're, you know, an employee at a dealership, you're listening to this and you've noticed this behavior at your store, maybe it's time to just look for a new relationship. What's another one?
That they're looking for somebody in a different department to TO their deals.
Oh, points for originality on that one. Okay. Or the TO managers always have the same material every time.
How about this classic sign that they won't actually invest in any training or development of your skill set?
Facts. Or the manager maintains all the information because they're afraid to transfer the knowledge.
Oh, gatekeeping monthly programs. Heavens to it. If you're in a store where you get a summary page that someone has done for you of the manufacturer programs because they think you can't figure out to add a point to a manufacturer special rate, reach out for help. Operators are standing.
Or they make you call 20 minutes on hold to get a payoff because they won't give you user base level access to Brought One or Dealer Track.
Yeah. I was saying logins for sure, holding back on giving you logins.
Yeah. How about they change the way that they pay you? And instead of giving you a washout sheet that actually shows the detailed transparent numbers of the deal, they just give you what you got paid.
Yes.
Typed up.
Or just showing the same, like, this was the gross.
Is that the new pack?
Yeah.
Or these new hires don't get their business cards for 6 months.
I was just about to say. They're going to work out.
Oh, yeah. How about you don't get your login to your CRM or your email? How about you're still using other people's business cards where you scratched out the last person's name and put in your own? Yeah.
No, and the name on the office can also be a good giveaway. Like either the guy that puts the names on the offices, either he's there every day and he's Johnny on the spot because they need him that much, or like the other way around, like there's still some other name that's on that office and a bunch of people, like you're not the only one type of a thing. But in any event, these are all good. And we're going to do there's going to be a great end of the year compilation. I hope. Anyway, I think it's a good idea that we could do that. But anyway, that's just my suggestion of all those signs that a dealership just might not be that into you. Anyway, thank you for joining us for a very special 20th episode of The Wheelhouse. I was going to say 20th anniversary. It's kind of our anniversary. We did 20 episodes of The Wheelhouse today. Thank you so much to the panel that joined us today. Thank you for those of you that joined along to watch or listen. And we'll see you again in another 2 weeks for an episode of The Wheelhouse.